Well, good morning, Lakeview. Good to see you. Welcome here. If you're visiting with us, if you're new to us, my name is Paul, and I have the honor of being the lead pastor here at Lakeview. Welcome here. Welcome this morning. Now, I don't know if any of you grew up with a Lent tradition, if you grew up practicing Lent, or if Lent is something kind of new for you. You're just kind of like, hey, I grew up in a church, but we actually didn't participate in Lent. Or maybe you didn't grow up in a church and you're just kind of inexperienced in the community and thinking, what is this Lent all about? Now, those of us that do practice Lent and starting at Ash Wednesday have given something up over the 40 days that leads us to the Resurrection Sunday, you might be beginning to ask yourself a few questions already. Those of you that are practicing, you might be saying things like, why did I even do that? What does this prove? Or maybe if you aren't, like you haven't done Lent tradition before, you are not practicing, you might be asking the same questions. Why would I do that? What would this prove? What would it prove for me to give something up? Like, does God really care that I have now given something up in my life? Does God really care that I'm doing this? You might be even tempted to justify and say that God in all his grace and mercy and sovereignty of God is so big and large. Does he really care about such little trivial things that like that I may have given up social media or I'm not having chocolate or desserts or whatever it is that those of us that are practicing Lent may have given up? We might be tempted to ask those questions. In fact, if we have seen no immediate results in us giving up something, we might be saying, is this even helpful? What does this prove? So as we continue our journey into the wilderness today, we will try to look at this part of the Lenten practice and the temptations that rise up from it. Now, last week, I said that our foundational passage for this whole series, for this whole journey, will be 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 to 13. 1 Corinthians is a letter that Paul writes to a church in Corinth, and by extension to all of us. And Apostle Paul, in his first 13 verses of chapter 10, parallels Israel's journey into the wilderness as an example for us not to follow. He uses it as something what we shouldn't do. He parallels their story to say, be careful, don't do as the Israelites did in the wilderness. So this is going to be our passage as we go through it, and we'll reread it often, and then I'll focus in on a verse or two to really place ourselves in a conversation. So last week, I read the first six verses, and we focused on verse six, which talked about desires and cravings, and we kind of explored the idea that all the desires come from God. And even our over-desires, our cravings, even when they go into places that are not healthy or not good, we should examine them because the desire behind that desire is actually a desire for God. So we're going to read the first six verses and then verse seven, which is where we're going to root ourselves today. And so last week I read it in the Message translation. Today I'm going to read it in the New Living translation. It's good to kind of have different paraphrases and translations available so we can kind of get really to the heart of what is being taught in this Holy Scripture. So join me. I'll read it, I guess. All right. I don't want you to forget, Apostle Paul starts in the letter in this chapter. I don't want you to forget, dear brothers and sisters, about our ancestors in the wilderness long ago. All of them were guided by a cloud that moved ahead of them, and all of them walked through the sea and dry ground. In the cloud and in the sea, all of them were baptized as followers of Moses. All of them ate the same spiritual food. All of them drank the same spiritual water, for they drank from the spiritual rock that traveled with them. And that rock was Christ. Yet God was not pleased with most of them, and their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. These things happened as a warning to us, so that we would not crave evil things as they did, or worship idols as some of them did. As the scriptures say, the people celebrated with feasting and drinking, and they indulged in pagan revelry. All right. So last week we focused on the crave part. We talked about these desires and things that rise up in us. And the crave word there in Hebrew is this, literally when in Hebrew language, when they want to make a point something, they double up on the word. So the word is actually like desire, desire, desire of desires. It's like this over desire. We kind of focus on that. And our verse today is really in the same sentence. It comes out of don't crave evil things as they did. And verse 7 is actually starts with or worship idols as some of them did, as the scriptures say that people celebrate with feasting and drinking and they indulge in pagan revelry. Now that's quite a statement, isn't it? Pagan revelry. I had to practice revelry. I don't use that word very often. And because English is my like second language, like stuff with V's is really hard to pronounce, revelry. So I had to like really make sure I say it well, because it's not a word I use very often. And I don't know, if you grew up in the church, there might be some images and ideas that come to your mind when you read something like pagan revelry. Or maybe you're new to the church and you're like, what does that even mean? Like, how does this, what is Paul warning me about? What is this all about? So to help us understand, we see that it's actually a quote that Apostle Paul is writing in this letter. And the quote comes from Exodus chapter 32, verses 1 to 6. And so to help us kind of get a sense of what Paul is talking about, let's just jump in now into the Exodus story that Paul is warning us about and read what is happening. And we read, when the people saw how long it was taking Moses to come back down from the mountain. Now, I'm just going to pause here for a second. Those of you that are here in the fall, we went through the book of Hebrews, and we unpacked by going back into the story of God to make sense of where God is leading us. And we talked about mountains and holy spaces, and this is that moment where Moses goes up a mountain, and people are like, where is he? So this is kind of the context here. So how long it was taking Moses to come back down from the mountain? They gathered around Aaron. Come on. I wonder if they actually said it like that. But come on, they said, make us some gods who can lead us. We don't know what happened to this fellow Moses who brought us here from the land of Egypt. So Aaron said, take the gold rings from the ears of your wives and sons and daughters and bring them to me. All the people took the gold rings from their ears and brought them to Aaron. Then Aaron took the gold, melted it down, and molded it into the shape of a calf. When the people saw it, they exclaimed, O Israel, these are the gods who brought us out of the land of Egypt. Aaron saw how excited the people were, so he built an altar in front of the calf. Then he announced, tomorrow will be a festival to the Lord. The people got up early in the next morning to sacrifice burnt offerings and peace offerings. After this, they celebrated with feasting and drinking, and they indulged in pagan revelry. There it is. There's the verse. Another translation puts it, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Now, reading this story out of Exodus, this journey of Israelites who find himself in the desert, Moses has gone up on the mountain, they don't know what's going on, we still could feel pretty far removed from the conversation. Like, maybe in Corinth this was still happening, so Paul has to warn them, but like, what does this have to do with us, pagan revelry? And we can pass even judgments on Israel as we read this story. We're like, how could they waver so much? Like, they saw God save them out of Egypt. They saw him perform miracles, the open of the sea, like God was walking in the fire ahead of them. How could they move away so quickly? How could they switch to worshiping in the way of Egypt? How could they go back to creating idols of gold? This last 3 weeks, we talked about that as God leads people out of Egypt, the wilderness is a place where he wants to take Egypt out of them, out of their hearts. And we see here that Egypt still has a structure and a place in their heart. And so it's easy to read this and judge them from this side of the story, because none of us, at least none that I know, would melt gold and make an idol to bow down. None of us would spend fortunes to buy something shiny and fancy and really, really want it in our life. It's like, that's not what we do, right? And so it's easy to judge and to scoff at the Israelites, but can I suggest that it's actually hard for us to see ourselves in the story because we don't actually often take time to focus on the Egypts and systems and structures that are in our hearts, that exist in our own life. I want to suggest that what Apostle Paul is highlighting for us to be careful about is how easily we too can be swayed. When all that we believe in, when all that we hope for, when all the things that we believe make sense in life stop working. Like life takes a turn in a way we didn't expect. When things happen in life that just really shouldn't happen. Our health of the loved ones, our finances, employment, community, relationships, when they begin not to work in the way we thought they would, what do we do when life doesn't work out in the way we thought it would? When God doesn't answer in the way we thought he would? Now for Israel, we see that they grow impatient, right? We read that they, in fact, they were so impatient, they begin to say things like, we don't know what happened to this fellow Moses. Like, you mean the guy that led you out of Egypt, like your leader? You call him fellow, you're like removing yourself from this relationship, we don't even know where he is. The wilderness has a way of revealing and exposing our hearts. It has a way of revealing what's actually going on behind the thing that we're doing or thinking. And so it is easy for us to read these stories and shake our heads and say, oh, wavering Israel. But can I suggest that one of the roots and the problems in this story of idolatry that Paul is talking about is actually the heart state of impatience. How often are we impatient with the work of God in our lives? How often do we want what we want now? In fact, I want us to catch and notice that it is in the wilderness that this impatience is exposed in their hearts. When their desires, when their hopes, when their dreams, when the things that should happen for them don't happen in the way that they expected. Now, I'm just going to put up two questions on the screen one at a time, and you can take a screenshot of them, because I'd want to welcome you to think about them through the week, or you can write them down if you're not a picture person. But where does your mind, and this is the same question I'm asking myself, where does my mind tend to go when impatience arises? Where does your mind go when impatience arises? Does it begin to blame someone? Does it become angry, frustrated, discouraged, annoyed? Where does your mind tend to go when impatience arises? And the second question I want us to kind of ruminate on and think through the week is, where do you tend to look when impatient? So there's things in your mind that come up, there's emotions and feelings that rise up, and where does that cause you to look when that happens? Apostle Paul warns the church of Corinth and us and spells it out. Really, what he's saying here is that impatience with God leads to idolatry. So we may not understand things like pagan revelry and be like, well, how does this connect with us? And we maybe even scoff at a word idolatry. But Apostle Paul is drawing out that in the wilderness, in our impatience, when God doesn't provide in the way we thought he would provide, this impatience causes us and leads us into places we probably would not venture into when life is full of abundance, when things are going well. Yet the scarcity of the wilderness exposes our hearts. When God is not showing up in the way or in the timely manner that we want, we gravitate towards things that will give us a personal grasp of those things that God is not providing, right? When impatience happens and God isn't doing what we thought he should do, we gravitate to things that we try to take control, power. We try to grab even love and take control of it. Holiness, knowledge. When God isn't coming through in the way we thought he might or when we thought he would, we look for other sources of things that only God can provide. Sometimes in our own power, or sometimes giving that source and that worship and worship to something else. Impatience simply leads to idolatry of control, power, love, holiness, and knowledge. It leads us striving to earn, to solve, and fix the gap, the problem. Our temptation then is to do that which only God can do. And here's the thing that's actually kind of like can throw us a little bit off balance, because we're actually really good at imitating God. Have you ever thought about that? We're actually really good at doing the things we want God to do. We can really solve some of the problems. They drank and feasted and played, we read. We are good at imitating God. We are good at putting other gods in God's space to allow us to do what we want done. That heavy word that Apostle Paul uses, idolatry, is simply doing and replacing what God should do in us and around us. Idolatry, maybe more succinctly and helpfully understood with the following. It could be, if I can just do it, if I can just have it or be this or that, I will be happy. So God's not providing it, so I will do it, I will get it, and then maybe I'll have some prestige out of it, maybe I'll make a name for myself, and then I'll be happy. So the wilderness exposes that instead of trusting God in the Israelite story, instead of trusting and resting in him, even though it's confusing, like, let's give Israelites some slack here. They're in a desert, and now their leader's gone, and God is not responding the way they thought that he would. He's not providing in the way they thought they would once they're free. So they're solving the problem. This is the God that will lead us. What we do, what we have, or the image that we're able to project in the world is a way we solve and fit the gaps that God is missing for us. Generally, we might not even have the awareness to say it so directly, right? Like, I'm spelling it out now, but we may not say it, but it's the undercurrent in our hearts because we are too impatient to wait on God to show up. And when this impatience is undetected, even for those of us who call ourselves Christian or those of us that say, I'm in Christ, even those of us who proclaim to love Jesus, if impatience is undetected, we can end up putting this idolatry actually into our relationship with God. Like, I trust God, but you know what? I'll do it. Because he's busy. He's got lots of things. He's not worried about my social media or my things. I'll do it. You know what? I really need this, and God's not providing. But you know what? I'll get this. I'll have this. I need this. I need to make a name for myself. After all, I am the image bearer of God. In a sense, we can idolize even God in our Christian relationships in an attempt to get our own independence and self-fulfillment through what we do, what we have, and what others think of us. So rather than the life depending and waiting and being patient on God, surrendering to his heart, we actually can begin to view God as one who can get us what we want. We can actually begin to idolize God and begin to see him as this candy machine. I put the quarter in, I did the prayer, God, now give me the candy. We can idolize and begin to feel that God is the one who gets us what we want. And if he doesn't, boy, we can make a great God who will lead us. So for the people of Israel, the text of Exodus 32 that Apostle Paul is quoting, is actually tragically fascinating. Aaron, the brother of Moses, has just built a golden calf. Then he pronounced, these are the gods that delivered you from Egypt. And announced the next day that they will feast to the Lord. Now, in this text, the word Lord here is the Hebrew word for God, which is Yahweh, which is like the most personal name for God. So there's three things that are happening here that we need to note in Paul's template of what not to do. First, they're attributing their release from captivity, from slavery, to false gods, one they just made. Now, secondly, they're not just saying, well, like, yeah, we just don't believe in Yahweh anymore. They're actually tying Yahweh into the worship of these other gods. They're actually colluding them and mixing them together, like, yeah, just the more the merrier. And third, they are personally solving the problem of God's silence. They can't rest in it. They have to solve it. God is not showing up in the way I thought. I can't sit still. I will do this. I will make this happen. And this is where it all kind of comes together in our message today. See, the temptations they have of not being able to sit in the silence, the temptations they have of God not showing up in the way they wanted him to be, are the same temptations that we see in the entire story of God. Now, if you're a follower of Jesus, if you read the Bible, if you've kind of been in the church for a while, it's the same temptations that Adam and Eve experienced in Genesis 3. It's the same temptation that Israel experiences in the wilderness. It's the same temptation that the kings of Israel experience. It's the same temptation that Jesus experienced in Matthew 4 in the desert, in the wilderness. And it's the same temptations that we wrestle with. So I just kind of put them together to parallel them here. So first one, fruit is good and satisfied. Adam and Eve in the Genesis 3, in the beginning of our story, Adam and Eve see the fruit that they're not supposed to partake of, but like, it looks good and looks satisfying, looks delicious. Temptation Jesus receives as he's hungry in the wilderness, turn these stones into bread. Temptation we face, what I do when God isn't providing the way I thought he would. Second temptation is like Adam and Eve in the garden. This fruit will give us the wisdom. We'll know the knowledge of good and evil. We'll be, you know, like God. I'll be wise because God is not helping me be wise apparently. So I'll do this. I will have this. Jesus then is in the desert and the enemy takes him and says, look at all the kingdoms of the world. This could be all yours. Just bow down to me. And temptation we have. What I have determines who I am. Because God sometimes isn't providing what I need or what I want in the way I want it. And finally, in the garden, the enemy convinces our first humanity that you will be like God. Take it, you'll be like God. He's keeping you away from that. He's putting a gulf between you and him. You're just not measuring up. Take this and you'll be like him. In Jesus' terms, the enemy says, throw yourself down because God would never allow for you to be hurt. So angels will protect you. Angels will keep you safe. And all will see that you are actually God. And the temptation that we face out of this, what will others think of me? So let's take a moment and just unpack these three temptations, how they're practically involved in our life as we look at the impatience that could lead to filling in the gap and worshiping something else instead of God, or solving or doing something that only God can do. So what I do. Now, when it comes to the deep soul work of this wilderness, this journey that I'm inviting all of us to participate in, we experience losses in the wilderness. Wilderness is not a joyful journey. We see it in Israel, we see it in Jesus, and we see it in our own lives. Wilderness journey is incredibly disorientating. The ways our lives have been defined are no longer in place. There's something that's shifted and changed. The things that we thought we knew have been removed, perhaps. The comfort of knowing what would happen next sometimes is gone. And even as people of Israel who were enslaved in Egypt, they were stripped away of all the things they knew how to exist, how to have life. All the systems were stripped. And now with unknowing and uncertainty, following God in this dusty and dry wilderness, they're confused. Because for them, for the Israelites, they were shaped over centuries to believe that their worth was rooted in what they could do. Make more bricks. Provide this. Build this. What they could accomplish was their identity. We may find we have similar shaping in our lives. It may have been maybe growing up, you maybe have heard things like make something of your life. Or maybe the society pressures that seemingly we're always asked, like, well, what do you do for a living? Or kids go to university, what are you going to be when you're done? And as we explore how the idolatry of what we do may be present in our lives, we may become overwhelmed. We may be thinking, well, I do need to do something. And now I'm confronted that, like, there's idolatry to what I do. Just please tell me what to do. We might find ourselves in that spot this morning. We may desire things to be simple and easy, but the realities of the heart are complex. We have a relationship with God, not a list of do this or don't do that. The journey of the wilderness is to expose and to reveal and to begin to dismantle these idols that become lodged in our hearts. And all of this takes time. And the impulse to do actually reveals a heart that has been shaped in a particular way. This can be part of the attraction, actually, of religious systems. Do's and don'ts. They're clear. And it doesn't take faith or trust, but simply either or of doing. Don't or don't. Or do or don't. We're either in or we're out. We either did it or we didn't. This can be our thought process. This could actually be attractive for us. Now, while it's not gracious or life-giving, it is manageable. However, God's heart for us is not to live a manageable life, but a life flowing with goodness and grace, rooted in a relationship with him. Friends, I know the relationship could feel like a fuzzy word. It's used in a lot of ways, and it can be perhaps even a bit vague. However, if we put it in terms of identity, we can ask, do I see myself at the core of my identity as a beloved son or daughter of God? See, our impatience with God to show up can cloud our identity as his child. And we are tempted to do and achieve and solve something that only God can do. The idol, or what we do, shows up at the core of who we are, which is deeply connected to the next temptation: what I have. Now, certainly in the wilderness, our wilderness journeys are often so shaped by loss or lack, and we are aware of what we don't have. It becomes very clear in the wilderness that I'm lacking here. And the idolatry of what we possess can be quite deceptive, because the possessions we have are generally good things. Having a house is a good thing. Having transportation for work and life is good. They're often needed things. The trouble arises is how we are possessing the things we have. And the wilderness lays us bare. We become aware that things are amiss and we are in need of deep soul work. And this is brought to our attention in the loneliness of the wilderness. Our impulse and impatience can be to deal with it on our own, to use our own resources to address our emptiness or nakedness or loneliness. The impulse to do that we just talked about in the first temptation becomes forward to what we have. The impulse to possess is a response to the experience of feeling that lack in the wilderness. And he shows up in many ways and in different situations. It could be we find our lacking in our finances, in good health. It could be that we find lacking in family, in nationality, knowledge, wisdom, relationships, experiences. The list could go on. Dismantling the idol of what we have occurs as we notice our attachment and clinging, and then trust that God's provision is not enough. The idol shows up when we feel that God is just not providing enough for me in this moment. The challenge for us is, do we believe what God provides for us will be enough? Can we be in the wilderness? Can we be patient when God isn't showing up in the way we have to provide for us, to give us what we feel we need? Do we believe that life in him is truly abundant? Or does it always seem like scarce? And are we noticing when our hunger and needs are being manipulated by the enemy? Where is this fellow Moses? Where is he taking us? Aaron, build us a God that can lead us. For Jesus in the wilderness, the enemy came to him in an attempt to exploit the real poverty Jesus was experiencing. We read next, the devil took him to the peak of the very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. I'll give it all to you if you just kneel down and worship me. You see the connection? But notice how Jesus responds. He doesn't deny that he has nothing. He doesn't say, oh no, I'm okay. This is fine. I like not having anything. He doesn't deny that. He doesn't deny that he's missing and he's lonely and he needs something. He doesn't agree. But he does refuse to circumvent his mission. He refuses to circumvent his mission to the cross, to gain adoration and possess all the kingdoms. After all, God is after the kingdoms of the world, as it is in heaven, so on earth. But he doesn't circumvent the journey to the cross. He refuses to be impatient with God in what God is going to do. So he says, get out of here, Satan, Jesus told him. For the scriptures say you must worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And the third temptation is what others think of us. In the wilderness spaces of life, one of the distinct features that can arise again is loneliness and be by ourselves and not sure, like, do people think I'm crazy? Like, what's happening here? And when suffering and the experiences of aloneness can be all these things can be very profound. Our response can be either to resist and to manage those difficult emotions with our own resources, or to discover how Jesus might desire to be with us in those moments. in those moments of isolation. Loneliness and feelings of alienation are common human experiences. We know this. And for many of us, we learn how to navigate them even from the early age, right? We learn how to do things to either get noticed by others or to stay off the radar so that wouldn't lead to any potential criticism of us. We've learned from a young age how to navigate those systems. And so as we continue to consider this idolatry that Paul is warning us about, Apostle Paul, we can make an idol of what others think of us. And so we have to be careful of that. It can be a place we go to receive what only God can give us. Oh, if people just cheer me on and know I'm awesome, then I'll feel like I'm loved. But we know from people who are cheered and loved loudly that that doesn't last. Because only God can offer that love that we deeply need. The people of Israel were collectively confronted with a sense of isolation and vulnerability. They're isolated. They're stuck in the desert. And the text in Exodus 32 simply notes that Moses delayed. Packed in that word delayed is certainly a sense of loneliness and abandonment. Where is this fellow? And rather than seeking God in that moment and being patient, the people went to what was familiar. Well, this system that we had before in Egypt, even though we were slaves, worked. That was manageable. We understood what to do. As Jesus journeyed in his 40 days, the devil sought to exploit his loneliness and isolation. In verse 6 of chapter 4 of Matthew, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hand they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against the stone. The temptation was not to put on a show. The temptation was to put on a show, to perform, to deal with this isolation, to deal with this loneliness, to show, here I am, here's all I have. Look at how the angels protect me. Look at this miracle that I'm doing. And yet Jesus simply responds, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. In other words, I'm not going to try to get God the Father to show up for me according to my perceived needs, but instead I will trust his love and plans for me and be patient. I will not grow impatient and create an idol and try to fill the gap that only God can fill. See, what Jesus did in all of this in the wilderness and did as an example for us, and what Israel failed, that Apostle Paul is warning us about, is that Jesus modeled rest instead of striving. Jesus modeled what it is to rest in God. Now, rest doesn't mean you just sleep and don't do anything. Rest is actually participating in God's activity, renewal of all things. In the garden, Adam and Eve were given tasks and jobs in God's presence. The Israelites were traveling from slavery through the wilderness to rest. Not that they could just sleep. Well, sleep is important. I'm not bashing sleep. But rest in this biblical sense is a place of being in God and not striving to fix and fill the gaps that God is not filling. This famous painting of Jesus depicted here by Ivan Kramskoy represents to us what the desert fathers, that's the early Christians who left urban life and they went into the deserts and the wilderness and believed that wilderness is incredibly valuable precisely because it has no value to us. The wilderness was the land that could never be wasted by man because it offered them nothing. There was nothing to attract them. There was nothing to exploit. So in our Lent journey, in this wilderness, we give up something. And we may be tempted to ask questions like, does this matter? Does God really care? Because nothing's really changing for me. But we do it so we learn patience and trust. We do it to learn patience and trust. We do it because we know that God will fill that gap, that I can't. And in our wilderness journey is the time to examine our hearts and our desires to exploit and to become our own gods or to create a God for ourselves. In the wilderness, we remind that we can imitate God pretty good, actually. Pretty good, but just for a while. Eventually, our imitation, our other images that we create, or what we do and what we have and what others think of us, eventually on their own, they fail. So the wilderness does the job well when it exposes those idols and that impatience in our lives. Friends, can I invite you this week? There's two questions that I asked earlier to ruminate on them, to think about them. But can I invite you into the practice of examine? It is in one of our spiritual practices on our website. And what I'll examine is just to examine our days, our weeks, and to see God moments in those days, to see where we were tempted to fix, to do, to have, to be seen in a way that took away from God, in the way we thought God was lacking for us, so we stepped in or we introduced something else as an idol to fix that gap. Can I invite you to this week to not just expose it, but to have time to meditate on it, to consider it, to pray about it, and invite God into your impatience. To invite God and say, God, I'm impatient in this moment. I thought it would work this way, and it's just not. I thought I would be here in life at this point, but I'm just not. I thought you would give me this, and you're just not giving it for me. Can I invite you to expose those desires and consider the temptations you're experiencing when those things rise up, and to trust God in this wilderness journey? Can I invite you to say, God, I don't know what's happening, and I am upset, and I'm not happy, but I want to trust you. I want to trust you. We read in the Bible, people writing, God, help me with my unbelief. Help me with our unbelief. The temptation of the wilderness is to step in and do what only God can do. And Israelites created an idol and had pagan revelry. And we can laugh at that and say, well, that's irrelevant to us. Except that when we begin to act like God and replace him and do only that he could do. Can we be reminded this week that our fullest life, our rest, can only happen in Christ alone? Would you pray with me? God, we thank you. We thank you that you are not far. Even though it feels like sometimes that you're not there and we become impatient and we try to solve these problems, you promise to be near. Help us to trust you, Jesus, alone. God, as we sing after this and as we respond in song, may it be the song of our hearts to trust you in those gaps, to not fix, to not build an idol, to not replace you by any means, but just to trust you. Would you comfort us in our wilderness journey as we trust in you alone? Pray all these things in your name. Amen. Amen.